Hello, and welcome to Learning English, the daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, created to help people like you learn American English. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you reports that tell you what is happening in the United States and the world. In these reports, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and expressions that are easy to understand. If you listen to this program and practice saying the words and sentences the way we do, you will quickly improve your American English skills. Now, let's get started with today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us about some of the challenges students from other countries face in the United States. Then, you will hear Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Ana Mateo will tell us about some of the many American English expressions using the word line. And finally, as we do every Sunday, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we continue the story of the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush. We begin with higher education correspondent Pete Musto.
Anyone who seeks a college education will face some challenges. These include difficult projects, busy schedules, and complex social situations. The new responsibilities of being an independent adult can be frightening. And for an international student, this experience can be even more intense. Over 1 million international students studied at the many colleges and universities in the United States last year. Many of them came from countries where English is not the native language. But language was not the only barrier they faced. ELS Educational Services is a company that operates several centers at colleges across the U.S. These centers help international students improve their English. In February, ELS researchers presented a study at the yearly conference of the Association of International Education Administrators. This study collected the opinions of 662 international students at 23 different U.S. colleges and universities. Many expressed concerns about their relationships with professors. More than a third said they wished their professors would provide additional helpful criticism. 33% wished professors would try harder to understand the international student experience. And 28% of the students wished professors would provide non-U.S. examples in class materials. John Nicholson is the Vice President of Marketing and Communications for ELS. Nicholson says the way students prepare to study in the U.S. affects their experience. He says many believe if they know enough English to pass a standardized test, they are ready for American higher education. But, he says, This level of language ability alone will not prepare them enough for their new learning environment.
Ultimately, to be successful in a classroom, you have to understand what the expectations are, but also the right way to express those concerns and questions.
Lisa Giragosian is the director of the International Student Office at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. She says the findings of the study are common among the students she meets. And she says teachers share in the responsibility for the difficulties expressed by international students.
For every faculty member who's very conscious and globally minded and seeking an international student's opinion, there's somebody else who's not. And I'm afraid sometimes we're dealing with the mentality that you're studying in the United States and getting the knowledge from this particular professor or class, and that being totally inclusive is not taking priority.
Giragosian argues that international students add a great deal to the experiences of American students. As a result, she says, professors need to be equally open and accepting of all their students. That is why Duke offers training programs for professors to better understand how their international students think and learn. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, Ana Mateo is here to explain some of the American English expressions using the word line.
Now, it's time for the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we talk about common expressions in American English. Today, we will talk about the word line. Line is a simple four-letter word, but it has many meanings, making a simple word complex. We will begin with an easy expression, in line. Now, you can simply stand in line at a store, bus stop, or at a theater. Not many people like standing in a line. But you can also be in line for something important, like a job or a job promotion. Being in line for a better job is something most people would like. Let's say a friend of yours, Simone, is an accountant. She has a good job and is in line for a promotion at work. Simone doesn't make much money, so you hope she gets the high-level, better-paying position. But Simone doesn't feel the same way. She has dreams of becoming a professional singer. She takes voice lessons every night and joins a singing group on the weekends. These activities change her lifestyle. She stays out late at night and comes in late to work. And she often sings at her desk. This behavior puts the likelihood of her promotion on the line. Something on the line is at a critical point or is at risk. Sometimes when using this expression, a person simply says, there is a lot on the line, or too much on the line, meaning that much can be lost. But let's get back to Simone. You begin to feel worried about her double life as a singer. You just don't think it's realistic. You want to tell Simone to fall in line, to follow the rules of her office. You remind your friend that her office has a hard line when it comes to showing up on time for work. A hard line means a severe, uncompromising way of acting. A hardliner is someone who sticks to some policy or rule. So her boss is a hardliner when it comes to showing up for work on time. He also doesn't like the accountants singing in front of the clients. But Simone doesn't listen. In fact, things get worse. She often leaves town for weeks at a time, touring around the country with her singing group. Now her job is really on the line. You walk the line between warning her about landing on the unemployment line and respecting her privacy. The expression walk the line has two meanings. One is to hold a position, usually on middle ground, between two very different choices. The other meaning of walk the line is the one Johnny Cash sings about. In his song, he sings about behaving well with the love of his life.
I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
There is a fine line between wanting to help someone and interfering. A fine line means a very small difference. After thinking about it, you decide to lay it on the line. To lay it on the line means to talk very openly with someone. Often it is something that the person may not want to hear. So you pull Simone aside and privately say, "Look, I'm going to lay it on the line for you. You need to take your job more seriously. Your whole career is on the line," or something along those lines. Along those lines means something like that. At first, she seems thankful that you care so much. Then she tells you not to worry. A music producer, she says, offered her singing group a record deal. You don't believe her. You say, "Don't give me that line." When you give, hand, or even feed someone a line, you are not telling that person the truth. Now we are at the end of the line for this Words and Their Stories. Drop us a line and let us know what you thought of this program. I'm Anna Mateo.
There's a fine, fine line between a lover and a friend. There's a fine, fine line between reality and pretend. And you never know till you reach the top if it was worth the uphill climb. There's a fine, fine line between love and a waste of time.
Thanks, Anna. Now we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we continue the story of President George Herbert Walker Bush. He was elected the 41st President of the United States in 1988.
George H.W. Bush was president when the Cold War ended between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War had lasted more than 40 years. Both sides were heavily armed with nuclear weapons. People worried that one wrong move could lead to the end of the world. But by the late 1980s, the world was changing. The Soviet Union was dying. On November 9, 1989, East Germany opened the Berlin Wall for the first time since it had been built. The wall had divided communist East Germany from democratic West Germany since 1961. Citizens and soldiers together soon began tearing it down. Tensions continued to ease as communist rule in most of the former Soviet republics ended by the early 1990s. 15 republics had belonged to the Soviet Union. By the end of 1991, most had declared their independence. They became a loosely formed group called the Commonwealth of Independent States. Countries that had considered the United States their enemy now looked to it to lead the way to peace and, they hoped, prosperity. As the Soviet Union was dying, President Bush repeatedly negotiated with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. One of those meetings took place in the spring of 1990 in the United States. It led to an agreement calling for both sides to destroy most of their chemical weapons. The two leaders also agreed to increase trade relations. The American and Soviet presidents met in Moscow in July 1991. There, they signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, known as START 1. This treaty called for both sides to reduce their numbers of long-range nuclear weapons. They promised to cut the number by about one-third over 7 years. START 1 became the first agreement between the two powers to order cuts in existing supplies of nuclear weapons. In September 1991, President Bush said the United States would remove most of its short-range nuclear weapons from service. He also said the United States would destroy many of them. The next month, the Soviets announced that they would do the same. On December 25th of that year, Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as president as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics came to an end.
Compatriots, due to the situation which has evolved as a result of the formation of the Commonwealth of Independent States, I hereby discontinue my activities at the post of President of the USSR.
6 months earlier, Russians had chosen Boris Yeltsin as the first democratically elected leader of Russia. When the Soviet Union collapsed, he became the most important leader of the former republics. President Bush and President Yeltsin signed another strategic arms reduction treaty, START 2, in January 1993.
Fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly.
One of George Bush's military actions as president was to send troops into Panama in December 1989. They captured the country's leader, General Manuel Noriega. The United States had charged Noriega with drug trafficking. He had also refused to honor election results that showed another candidate winning the presidency. President Bush said he also sent troops to the Central American nation to protect the 35,000 Americans living there. The American troops easily defeated Noriega's forces. He was taken to the United States, where he was tried, found guilty, and sent to prison for many years. The United States then supported the presidency of Guillermo Endara, the winner of the election in Panama.
5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
In August 1990, Iraq invaded its neighbor, Kuwait. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution threatening war on Iraq unless it withdrew from Kuwait. The Council set a deadline of January 15, 1991, but Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein refused. The United States and other nations were receiving much of their oil from Kuwait and neighboring Saudi Arabia. President Bush succeeded in forming a coalition with 38 other countries against Iraq. The purpose was to free Kuwait and protect Saudi Arabia against a possible Iraqi invasion.
This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries. Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait. Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice. Our Secretary of State, James Baker, held an historic meeting in Geneva, only to be totally rebuffed. This past weekend, in a last-ditch effort, the Secretary General of the United Nations went to the Middle East with peace in his heart, his second such mission, and he came back from Baghdad with no progress at all in getting Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait.
Coalition forces began an air war against Iraq on January 17, 1991. They bombed Iraqi targets in Iraq and Kuwait. On February 23rd, the Iraqis set fire to hundreds of Kuwaiti oil wells.
It looks like what I envisioned hell would look like. The country of Kuwait is burning.
The coalition had the long and difficult task of putting those fires out. On February 24th, the Allied ground war began as part of the operation known as Desert Storm. That ground war lasted just 100 hours. Saddam Hussein withdrew his forces from Kuwait, but he was still in control of his own country. Years later, some Americans continued to criticize the Bush administration for not trying to oust the Iraqi leader. They believe that Bush should have sent forces to capture Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. After the war ended, Kurds in northern Iraq rebelled against Saddam Hussein. So did Shiite Muslims in southern Iraq. The Iraqi government crushed both uprisings. The defeated Kurds fled to Iran and Turkey and into the mountains of northern Iraq. President Bush ordered American troops to help give humanitarian aid to the refugees. The troops established refugee camps for the Kurds. As time passed, Iraqi soldiers and aircraft continued to attack the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south. Coalition forces led by the United States established no-fly zones barring Iraqi aircraft over northern and southern Iraq. Coalition planes enforced these no-fly zones in the years that followed. By late 1992, drought and conflict had caused widespread suffering in Somalia.
I want to talk to you today about the tragedy in Somalia and about a mission that can ease suffering and save lives. Every American has seen the shocking images from Somalia, The scope of suffering there is hard to imagine. Already, over 250,000 people have died in the Somali famine. In the months ahead, 5 times that number, 1.5 million people could starve to death.
The violence and the collapse of the government were keeping many Somalis from receiving food and other aid.
The security situation has grown worse. The UN has been prevented from deploying its initial commitment of troops. In many cases, food from relief flights is being looted upon landing. Food convoys have been hijacked, aid workers assaulted, ships with food have been subject to artillery attacks that prevented them from docking. There is no government in Somalia. Law and order have broken down. Anarchy prevails. One image tells the story. Imagine 7,000 tons of food aid literally bursting out of a warehouse on a dock in Mogadishu while Somalis starve less than a kilometer away because relief workers cannot run the gauntlet of armed gangs roving the city.
President Bush, in the last year of his term, sent American troops to Somalia to assist in the aid efforts. But the following year, in October of 1993, 18 American soldiers on a raid were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. More than 80 others were wounded. That failed operation would haunt the American military for years to come. The events of that day were the basis for the book and movie Black Hawk Down.
In December of 1992, as Bush was about to leave office, he and the leaders of Canada and Mexico signed the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA called for removing taxes and other barriers to trade in North America. Some Americans accused Bush of sacrificing American jobs to lower-paid workers in Mexico by supporting NAFTA. Others praised him for supporting the agreement, which still had to pass Congress. By the time it did, George Bush was no longer president. He had lost his campaign for a second term. In November of 1992, he lost the election to the Democratic governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton. That will be our story next Sunday here on Learning English. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and hear longer versions of the stories that you have just heard on this program. You can also read, listen to, and download our other programs at the website. Was this program helpful? We'd like to know your thoughts. Send us a message through our website or send us an email. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. We read every message you send. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, iTunes, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. And be sure to listen to VOA World News at the beginning of every hour Universal Time, every day of the year. That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.